All right, today on Deep Thoughts, we're going to talk about aliens. Do they exist? And who has them? Who's talked to them? Where are they? Et cetera, et cetera. Welcome back to Deep Thoughts. There used to be a time when man believed a lot more than he does today. And then there was a time after that where man believed almost nothing, comparatively speaking. And then more recently, we have awakened through television, through film, and now the internet, to pass our consciousness between each other to see maybe if we agree on something. Thank you to Kristen and Ray, who got me this beautiful cigar for my birthday. And to Kyle, who got me a whole box of Baccarat, fueling the shows that you enjoy. So the whole idea of aliens is obviously extremely intriguing because it is almost like religion. It's something we can't prove. So it's in a big way, it's a faith-based belief system. Now, I know a lot of you click into this, you're going to go, whoa, we got photographs, we got movies, we got all kinds of testimonies. And that's where it gets interesting. Because prior to that, it would have been reading Ezekiel out of the Bible with all this crazy stuff flying out of the sky. It's looking at hieroglyphs in the Mayan temples, which seem to really suggest vehicles that can travel through the air, you know, that have a heavy level of complexity and seem to sort of coincide with some of the modern technology that we have today. And there's also hieroglyphs in Egypt, where people who, again, don't study hieroglyphs, I spent 6 years studying hieroglyphs, there are various symbols that, if combined, will actually look very similar to UFOs, Apache helicopters, that kind of thing. But it's really just an overlay of two different phrases going together. And I know that some people don't want to believe that, but that's actually the truth. I don't think, just to give you an example, I don't think that the Egyptians, of all people, would believe in aliens and then not embed them directly into everything that they do. If there were aliens back in that time, the Egyptians were those aliens, and we are descendants of them or benefactors of them, etc., etc. So when you click on an episode like this, you're like, oh my God, we're going to get straight into all the details and stuff, and we're going to get there. We're going to get into Roswell. We're going to get into the technologies that are supposedly grabbed out of these UFOs. We're going to talk about the Stephen Greer's Disclosure Project. We're going to talk about the power structure that UFOs actually give military if you believe. That's also very, very important. I'm going to touch on Bob Lazar. And Roswell is going to be the only crash I really get into, even though we know there's a lot more, because the minutiae of the crashes seems to... It doesn't really get any better than Roswell. Let's just put it that way. Now, we tend to poo-poo Roswell because it's 47, and these other ones have happened more recently, and, you know, supposedly we have audio recordings of people approaching these crash sites, whatever they were, and talking about it. And of course, we now have people who are alive today that we can still talk to. You know, the doctor's son is still alive from Roswell, or at least we got plenty of videotaped, you know, interviews from him. But I want to start off with the fundamentals. Because the fundamentals are, why would you want to believe? Why is it such an exciting subject? Because it is. It's totally exciting, right? And we have to be careful that when we tend to want to believe something, we tend to believe it. And there's really nothing wrong with that. You could get your own life. You could do what you want. And maybe pretending to believe will actually help you find the evidence to believe. So maybe there's a big benefit to that. I think, just to review very quickly, there's a couple things that we like about the idea that aliens are around, that they're participating in our lives, that they actually do show up on the White House lawn or the Super Bowl halftime show. Because mathematically, without knowing it or not, we know that they would have had to have mastered an amazing level of technology, and through doing so, we can assume that they've mastered other technologies, maybe more related to health or something. And so we're assuming that if they can get to us and they can talk to us and we can be friendly to them and they can be friendly to us, then we could exchange this amazing upgrade. We can teach them about us. That's what they get from it. And they can give us knowledge to cure cancer, to have zero-point energy systems, zero gravity, travel the stars, visit their place, and essentially expand the consciousness of man, right? So that's exciting as hell, right? For those of you holding a weapon going off to war, well, hopefully that would end too. Hopefully we can just all settle down and say, man, you know, maybe it isn't Jesus and Allah. Maybe it's us in the universe. And it's the same belief system, but just with different names, right? So that's where I think the seed of the allure comes from. And we need to recognize the seed of allure before we go into a belief system. A lot of people are Christian because they believe that in the end, you know, there's going to be this amazing judgment day. And if they follow the rules, they get to go off and live a whole euphoric life in heaven, which by my understanding of that would be hell. But, you know, doing the same thing every single day with all knowledge. No more exploration? No thanks. But it's that seed that fuels them. And we have our own seed inside the ufology groups here. Now, let's move into the one and only Roswell crash, 1947. This story has evolved so much over time that it's hard to believe any iteration today because it's been continually changed. And I'll just go through some of the changes. So the fundamental story that I have read, and I'll tell you where I read it, which is kind of an odd place. And, you know, everyone's heard about it, but in terms of reading the ultimate details, I'll just tell you, I got it out of a book written by Whitley Strieber. Some people say Strieber, I say Strieber, called Majestic. And it's actually a little paperback book. He sort of has it filed under nonfiction because he wants you to believe that he talked to a guy that told him all this stuff. Fine. That's cool. It's very entertaining regardless. And it sort of isolates a lot of the conspiratorial facts around the day. So it's a good read no matter what. And it's sort of hard to find, so you might have to go through Amazon to get it. But it's called Majestic. So the story is that there's a UFO flying that explodes from the inside in the middle of a really bad electrical storm and lands in a farmer's field. And there's a big chunk of the vehicle, and then there's a side that's blown out. And the side that blew out left these foil pieces about the width of a cigarette paper, but that when they found them, they had this perfect curve to them, even though they're really tiny, and you could wad them up and let go, and they would come back to shape. It's an alluring little story about some tinfoil paper that was extremely dense. Now, there was all the stories about having tried to penetrate this stuff, burn it, tear it, rip it, poke it, and nothing that modern man did to it ever altered its composition. They could ever break it, and when they let go, it always went back to its original shape that they found it in. Kind of cool. If you want to tell me alien tech has been discovered, show me that shit on planet Earth, right? And they're working on it, right? But we're working on it. We don't have it. We're working on it because we don't have it, right? Now, this is where the story sort of differs. Most stories say, hey, the farmer came and found all these different pieces and picked a bunch of them up. And then he actually was the one that called the Air Force, supposedly, when he found the saucer. And, of course, the Air Force sends out a crew. There's a report published in an Air Force newspaper saying that a saucer crashed. It wasn't a big article. It's actually kind of interesting. Published in a bunch of local locations around the Air Force base. And then they went and picked them all up and got rid of them after they confiscated this saucer with creatures. Now, the story deviates intensely at the moment of actually walking up to this, what was rumored to be about a 30-foot disc that for the most part was weightless. And you could actually, they said they pushed it on the back of a flatbed truck. With no problem, but it was kind of wobbly. Now, one of the stories says that you have three aliens inside there that are all dead. Another story says two of them are dead, but one of them is alive. And Strieber takes it further in that he was saying that they actually had hybrid alien children in there. appeared to be surgically altered, sort of thing. So that obviously puts the fear in God, a fear of God in you, that somehow aliens are coming down and messing with children. Children are the things that we are maternally set up to protect. So it excites the mind. Only in Whitley Strieber have I really heard about the children splicing thing. Crossbreeding is everywhere in the stories of aliens, right? That's a little bit better where they grew up the way they are, and so there's no pain or suffering. Now, the story continues to deviate incredibly when you read every single person's version of the Roswell Bible. In terms of where the ship actually ended up and how it was transported is phenomenally complex. I would have to probably spend 30 minutes just reading to you the deviations and where this thing went. That's where you get the big Hangar 18 movie. It's where you get, Area 51 was the big space that was supposed to be the secret UFO hideout my entire life until the internet showed up. And then we had knowledge of S4, which I believe has been confirmed enough by normal government employees who refuse, I should just put this way, they've categorically denied with major details that S4 has anything to do with aliens, that has any, you know, Area 51 has anything to do with aliens. They just simply say, we build covert aviation technology and a few other little related issues. You can almost assume drones and that kind of stuff. And he goes, look, we're just trying to keep it out of the eyes of our enemies so that nobody knows what we're doing and what our strategic capabilities are. Our weaknesses are in there as well as our strengths, right? But there's all kinds of other ancillary stories about Roswell that is fascinating, from people coming back to the receptionist with supposedly boxes, having bits and pieces of this flying saucer in it with rulers that have certain foreign writing on it. Supposedly, we captured microchips, Velcro, and fiber optics out of Roswell. Those are the three big ones that are always used. And I want to just take it down the line because, again, you might want to believe that. And it's, again, it's alluring to think that we had a jump in technology and the fact that this stuff just suddenly existed. But that's the way it normally happens. You know, in a blip of time, something comes from nothing to something because someone had an idea. Take alternating current that Tesla created, right? Nikola Tesla. There is none. And then he creates it. You know, he came to America with full knowledge of how to make it. He just was trying to get someone to start a company. Edison busts his ass and creates a light bulb, but only, you know, if you take 30 years of his R&D, that's a blip in time when you look backwards. You just look at 30 years like it's no big deal. Velcro is a natural occurring thing in plant life. It's essentially a hoop with a hook, and the hook is in there on the hoop, and when you pull on it, the hoop gives away, and then you have this little sticky thing. Now, the story goes is that the alien dudes had Velcro that held their suits together, and that's where they found it. And all I can say is the shit must have worked a hell of a lot better than the shitty wallets we had in the 80s. No slight to Robert Kiyosaki. I'll let that be an inside joke for you. So the other one is fiber optics. Now, fiber optics, what is it? It's a glass. In its traditional form, it was a glass extrusion, right? You push glass through a little tiny hole and you create this big wire of glass, and you can put a light on one end and put a sensor at the other end, and you pit it and it lights on the other end. Then you can put a light at the other end, a sensor on the other end, and you could go back and forth and send binary data. And by varying light frequencies, you could get other registers and other values, right? But at minimum, on off, right? So you have zeros and ones. Anyone who's had a coffee table, a kitchen table made of glass as a child, has put a flashlight accidentally up against a table and you see it shoot across the glass and makes the edges glow. And if you pay attention, it projects on the wall on the other side. And we've had glass since the days of the Egyptians, right? Glass is something that serendipitously came out of lightning hitting sand, and then they would dig it up and they'd find these incredible structures, and then they started polishing it and started realizing, well, this was hot. When we touch it, it burns our hands. So if you heat up glass or heat up sand by hand through a forge, you can actually make glass. By putting certain dyes in, you could get different colors, right? And I believe the Egyptians have red and blue glass that to this very day we're a little puzzled how on earth they created such rich colors, because we struggle today to accomplish what they did back in the day. Seems to be the theme of Egypt, right? So I'll loop back to the Egyptians, too. It's not all, aliens is not all tied to just UFOs. But to finish up fiber optics real quick, fiber optics, you know, it was something that we were always trying to figure out how to transmit data. And when we built our first transistor computers to help during World War II to calculate calculus algorithms of artillery shots, it was something that we knew that we were constantly creating these wires and we're constantly putting voltages over them. So to have it be a frictionless, you know, instantaneous light speed technology of fiber optics was ingenious. They realized that this could happen. I just think that the lineage of light going through glass and being registered in someone who's constantly, when you're inventing something that's trying to move binary digits, you're constantly observing anything that's ones and zeros constantly, right? And so it's not a huge stretch that man created fiber optics, okay? You know? So the second one is microchips. Microchips is a little more fascinating to human consciousness because they're very complex if you don't have the fundamental knowledge of silicon and the fundamental knowledge that photons burn silicon, certain levels of photons. So we have silicon that we can pour out in a flat surface and spin it, which makes it beautifully and, you know, thin. We've been doing this for records forever. And when exposed to light, it digs into the silicon emulsion. And then you can pour another layer on top and hit it and pour another layer on top and hit it. And what you're doing is you're actually creating a whole logic gate inside silicon pathways. And for instance, a transistor, which is what you always hear are now inside of microchips, it was built in a wire. You know, we have a single wire going up to a yes, no, and a null gate. And it can be set to remember the way it was positioned so that when logic comes down a circuit, you can actually calculate. And so you can store numbers inside transistors in terms of what that particular gate means. If this transistor is considered an old-fashioned computer, the number 8 at the decimal level of, you know, position 3 from 0, then you actually can move that up and down and calculate. And so what they've done is they've simply created that physical gate inside a silicon chip. A lot of you guys will know how automatic transmissions work. And they have this big chunk of steel that has all these kind of anthills inside them where they've been dug out where the hydraulic, you know, the transmission fluid goes in there, and they can push and prod on these tubes to get certain logic to happen for gear ratios. Well, it's almost exactly the same, except it's flat, you know, infinitely flat silicone carrying electrons, which are a bit like water, which is a bit like fluid in a transmission. So it's an interesting correlation between sort of that thinking. So in terms of Roswell being absolutely validated through alien participation, through technology that we grab from them, I think it's a loose argument at best. Now, what's interesting about Roswell is you do actually have the son, who I believe became a physician, who he saw this foil. I mean, he's given testimonies that he saw it, that you could do all those things that they did, crunch it up, and it would roll itself back. And so the idea that the most recent cover-up story of the whole thing was that it was a Russian probe that was actually shot down somehow, or he got hit by lightning and then crashed in Arizona, that's a bit hard to believe. So taking a break from Roswell, we'll put a pin in that. Let's talk about, since Roswell, and in Whitley Strieber's book, Majestic, he talks about the formation of the CIA as a formal body because of this child abduction theme that he says that has, you know, just been the case of mothers that say they're pregnant and all of a sudden they have children missing out of their wombs. I don't know if that's true, but part of the idea there is to say abortions were also very taboo. So who knows, you know, if a woman wants to get a child taken out of her, then maybe this is a way to, I mean, not to say alien stories are to cover it up, but, you know, a woman just reports that this thing disappeared and someone else attaches to that woman the UFO abduction thing. And then you have people that say they've been abducted. And Whitley Strieber is heavily, heavily into the alien abduction story because his first book, Communion, which I read, talks all about him being abducted in upstate New York. And for those of you who haven't read the book, it's actually very interesting. he essentially tells his story about being abducted. Now, if you read his other two books, Breakthrough and or Transformation and then Breakthrough, you end up seeing his pattern of desperation to be involved with this. And I'll put it to you this way. Every single testimony he would read or hear from another person, he would immediately have had that experience. And that tends to show a psychosis of someone actually wanting to be not left out of any anomaly that is alien. So, I mean, I'm telling you, like, if you took 10 of your friends that had been abducted by aliens or have that story, and they all have something very unique in their stories, Whitley Strieber would listen to every single one of them and say, I've had all 10 of your experiences. It keeps him special in his own mind, and he gets to sell books. And I'm not sure, you know, he shows up at a lot of UFO conferences now, so I don't mean to slight him. He's an extremely talented guy, and Majestic is a beautiful book. But there was something very interesting that happened to me personally. I'm going to take a break from some of the science here, loose science that I'm going through. I'm buying some books at a bookstore. I think it was a B. Dalton bookstore in California, which I don't think exists anymore. And, you know, there's these bargain bins off to the right of the registers trying to lure you into a few easy items. And I remember looking down at the side right of one of these things, and there was the book Communion, which the face of it had a painting of like a beige alien. It had a very flat head, almond eyes, slit for a mouth, tiny little nubs for noses, and just a normal body. You didn't really get to see it. It's more like from here up. And I bought the book for one very specific bizarre reason, which to this day I can't explain to you, which is I looked at the front of that cover and I said, someone got it right. Someone got what they look like correct. It was just this overwhelming joy feeling of, fuck yes, someone got it right. Now, to explain that one step further, I watched all the original Star Treks with my dad. Reruns, right? And every time I'd see an alien with especially almond eyes, and this is in a bunch of movies too, but portrayed with a big, giant, veiny, bulbous head, like they have giant brains, the old B-movies in the 50s and 60s, I had this sinking feeling of almost anger that the artists had it wrong, that they don't look like that. And I don't know why. To this day, I cannot tell you why. And I try to dial back and go, where would I have manifested such an opinion? Did I see something else first? And then this was the second thing I saw. And it's like the answer is no, 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 no. I had never seen anything painted like the book cover of Communion before I saw it. So, unless I got hit on the head and forgot it. So I bought the book. And the book is about his literal introduction into alien abduction and the fact that he had always been kind of abducted throughout his life and didn't realize it. Now, if I'm going to give this guy any credibility, I would say the following might be true. If aliens do exist, Whitley Strieber might have been abducted in his past. And then he has this void, like Steven Spielberg said he had some weird experience he's not sharing with anybody. And you have this void of having the experience again. And then the movie E.T., Spielberg supposedly put inside the story something that where he portrayed himself as the intelligence agent that showed up to the kid's house. And because the kid was having his abduction, or not abduction, his alien experience. And now the guy gets to come back and meet E.T. again. Supposedly he had seen him in the past, right? So in terms of Whitley Strieber continually writing books, Transformation, Breakthrough, and other stuff, I don't follow him anymore, but I got the sense that it was this almost desperation in the addition of books to say, I'm still here, I'm still getting abducted, and I even bring friends to upstate New York and they get abducted too, and it was just got kind of totally crazy in his books. But the first one is either brilliantly written and completely convincible and it's fake, or it is a very interesting true story about his life. Again, I'm not going to take either thing away from it. It'd be foolish to say I know, right? I'll say it's convincing. So here's what happens to me while reading this book. I'm living in Oxnard, California, in a beach house, three houses from the water, and I'm renting the first floor with my girlfriend. And we're a new couple. I'm really young. I'm like 21. And I'm reading this book to her, and it's getting towards Christmas time, and I'm reading this book to her, and so she had gotten some presents. She's from Queens, New York, so she'd fly to New York, buy me presents, bring them back to me. And I even though we're new in a relationship, I just had my birthday in August, and so I had experienced one present-giving thing after a trip to New York. And I was heavily into music, and so she'd bring me these 12-inch singles of the bands that I dug, but they were utterly crazy, injection molded, beautiful, you know, like illustrations in them. And she had just done a trip, went back before Christmas, came back and brought a bunch of presents in. And one of the presents was a flat, you know, thing, looked like an LP. And I'm reading the story to her, and the story is actually getting super interesting. It was at the point where Whitley was talking about missing time. Like, he'd be in his house and he'd blink his eyes and he'd be dark, and he'd go cook something in the refrigerator, cook something in the oven, and the time on the oven would change really fast. And he was starting to try to escape his house to get to his friends, and he starts seeing them chasing him and stuff. So it was a very interesting, compelling part of the story, which was scary. And that's what he's normally known for his books that have turned into Hollywood movies. And so we go to bed one night, and I'm telling you this story because it happened to me, it was witnessed, and it was weird. Now, in Whitley's world, you have to understand that the main working force of aliens in his world are gray aliens. There are tall, beige aliens, so your grays are about 4 feet tall, and your beiges are 6 feet plus. And you kind of get the sense that the grays are the boys and the beiges are the females. And then he has a shorter race that's like 3 feet that are like these little stocky blue guys with round eyeballs. They tend to wear what looks like a World War II helmet, like a plate upside down. And when you get abducted, what was the case was that they would pick up, these little guys would fill up your entire room, and they create a conveyor belt over their head, lifting you out of bed and pushing you through. After an alien would actually, a gray would pop you in between the eyes with the ruler to make you go in stasis mode, which is where you get sleep paralysis, where you're awake, but you can't move your body. Now, everyone's had that feeling at night. And it's actually kind of interesting that, you know, when you wake up in that state, it just happens chemically sometimes where your body's trying to keep you subdued for sleep, but your consciousness all of a sudden powers through and you can feel like you can't escape your bed. Absolutely happens to everybody. That I think it does. Eventually, if you live at least 40 years, it happens to you once. It could be terrifying when it happens. But these blues will carry you outside, put you in a little hammock, and then the hammock levitates up to the ship. And then you get surgically messed with up there. And he's all into the anal probing and all this other stuff, which if you just take a look at the idea that you could fly interstellarly between planets, you can gene splice humans with aliens, which is one of his big story points, that somehow they would have to get something out of your colon. It's absurd, right? So I don't believe any of that crap at all. I just don't. But I wake up from sleeping, and it was sort of in between dream state where you absolutely do not have the tangibility of real life, right? You know a dream is not real. You don't know it when you're in it, but when you wake up, you realize, I was missing a lot of my senses at the time. Well, what this thing did, so what ends up happening is I wake up in this kind of quasi state. I'm almost completely conscious, but I'm really kind of tired, and I'm acting in this really melancholy way, which is strange. And for those of you who've heard every single episode of MK Ultra, you would have heard this story in some torn up form. I am sitting on a amplifier. It's a music amplifier for a keyboard, and we're using it as it's like a Marshall stack, and we're using it as the Christmas tree because we didn't have one. So all the presents are under my legs. And I'm staring straight at a blue alien, or a gray alien, sorry. Almond eyes, everything. And I'm just like I'm sitting down right now, he was about my height right here. And this is not 4 feet yet. It's about 4 feet, it's about right up in here. And he's staring at me, and he goes, "Are you going to be all right?" Now, just to describe the room real quick, because it's interesting, is that and it's sort of Spielberg-y, right? So my brain's thinking, well, you jacked it up like a movie, so this is definitely a dream. And it could have been a dream. But regardless, this story has a cool punchline no matter what. Over to my left was a kitchen table that we had assembled. And back in the day when you used to stain your own furniture and stuff. And we had a big puzzle on there. We used to build puzzles. And way behind me is a sofa and then the wall, and it wraps around it where I am. So I'm sitting next to a wall. And there's a television sort of in front of me on this box. So he's between that and me. Now over here, I've got a bunch of aliens, probably a bunch of grays that are probably about 6 to 8, and they are moving mega fast. They stop. Most of them are stopped, but then when one moves, it's like super duper fast, like blurry fast, like Hollywood blurry fast, right? And it looks like they're analyzing the puzzle, almost like building it. I can't say I ever saw them put a piece in, but they were definitely doing something. And they're bent over looking at the table. And it seemed like, even though it didn't make any sense, there was like one that would zip around the perimeter of the room, like they were taking inventory of whatever the hell was in the room. I don't know what the hell. I have no knowledge of what they were doing. If you think it's the coolest dream I've ever had. But I'm looking at this guy, and he just says to me, "Are you going to be all right?" It was so comforting and wonderful. It wasn't like I was freaked out, but I was in this weird melancholy state. And I remember choosing my own words, and I said, "I guess." I said, "Well, I know." I said, "But no one's going to believe me." And he looks at me, and he put his little hand on my shoulder. That's a cool thing. It's like just the way I'm looking at you in this camera. He put his little right hand on my shoulder, my left shoulder, and he pauses for a beat, and he reaches down between my legs and pulls up this present that I think is a record, and he goes, "If I told you what's in this present, would they believe you?" And that's when I went, "I guess," you know. And about that time, it took a little while for this to kind of happen. It must have been about a 30-second to 60-second moment, because I am kind of looking around. He's letting me look around, you know. And he goes, "It's origami paper." And he puts it down between my legs. I close my eyes, and I wake up on my side in a twin bed. The clock is 1200. It's broad daylight, and my girlfriend's washing dishes out front. That room I'm in has a kitchen right behind me, so it's all one giant room. And so I get up, and I'm in my underwear, which is I was in my underwear when we had this thing happen. I've now changed my sleep regimen a little. And I go outside, or go out front. I sit down in front of the presents, and I'm looking right at this thing, and I'm thinking, it's a freaking album. It's perfectly square. I mean, wouldn't origami paper be 8x11? That's what paper's cut as, right? For those of you who've seen origami paper, you're already smiling. But it's also huge. It's huge paper, right? It's the size of like a 7 to 12 inch single. So she's washing out a pan, hitting it with the suds and all that stuff. And I looked at her and I said, "You know, I had this crazy dream last night." And again, we were reading communion every night, so the idea of aliens in the conversation was kind of funny. And I said, "I had an alien tell me what's in this gift, and I'd already touched it. The goddamn thing was soft. Yes, it's origami paper. Never seen the stuff in my life. I've never seen it anywhere up to this point in my life, and quite frankly, since then, I've barely ever seen it." But she's smiling, and she's, you know, using one of these little sponges on a wand thing, and she's smiling, and she goes, "Oh, yeah?" And this little grin on her face. And I go, "Yeah, he told me this is origami paper." And she stops. And she looks at me and she says, "Well, he better not have told you what your big present is." And she was a tough chick, you know. So I was like, "Oh, crap. This is origami paper." And at that point, there was never any question in her mind. And I don't know why I didn't push the issue. But it was origami paper. And it was a book on how to fold it as one of the other gifts. Bizarre. And so 10 years later, maybe even 15 years later, I think I contacted her through social media and I said, "Hey, you remember that time I said this?" She's like, "Yeah." And I go, "Well, didn't you think that was weird? Like, what did you think happened? Did you think I opened the present, looked at it, and then wrapped it back up again and then told you an alien story? Isn't that a little much of a stretch, right?" Now, her answer is actually interesting, and if it's true, one of the two solutions are probably true. Hers was that she had driven all the way to Los Angeles from Oxnard, and it's about a 50-minute to an hour drive to go to Santa Monica to find this paper because nobody had it in Ventura County. So it's a big effort just to get this piece of paper, right? Now, then I blow the cover on it by having this dream or whatever the hell it was, right? She said, "Well, I think it was because we were sleeping in a twin bed." Very soon we got a queen-size bed, but we got a twin bed, and it was because we were sleeping back-to-back or we're spooning or something like that you read my mind. Isn't that cool? I mean, isn't that freaking, that's a good story too. That's a good, you know, realization as well. And so that for me sort of said, wow, you know, you could be reading a book and then somehow this occurs to you. Now that little story happened to me, and I don't think I have a second story for you, but now here's what's interesting to me personally. There's something called the Project Disclosure. And it's a group of guys run underneath a dude named Stephen Greer, Dr. Stephen Greer, who was a physician, an ER physician, who I think his story is a little wonky, and a lot of the testimonies that he puts forth from people, because he videotapes people's testimonies and just collects them, you know, and I think 98% of the testimonies are as fake as they possibly could get. People saying that they'll start talking about an event that they were involved in where there's a an alien, you know, encounter. And as soon as they have to say the word alien, as soon as they have to say words like spaceship, their tics start going crazy in their face. They'll rub their ears all of a sudden when they say the words. It's really interesting. But they've got a couple doozies in there that I'm telling you, man, it's either these guys have been brainwashed to believe what they believe or they saw what they saw, you know. But now what Stephen Greer said, which was very interesting, was he said that he takes this group of people out every once in a while and they meditate. And Whitley Strieber does this too. And Whitley's actually got photography, and both of them have photography, where they'll sit out there in a field and they'll just meditate, sending out the vibe to the aliens to say, we're here, we would love to see you, and then lights start to show up in the sky, and it's just literally dancing pins of light that move around. Again, Strieber's got footage of this, I believe Stephen Greer has footage of this, and so there's almost like this turn in the story where consciousness is the key. Consciousness is the phone call system to phone home, right? If my alien side of the story is actually true, and it's not just a dream manifested, which it could be a dream, I have no problem with it being a dream, then it would have been this telegraphing call signal that I was getting out of communion to think about them constantly. And when he made me afraid of them, which is the last passage I read before going to bed that night, that maybe they're I'm just speculating, a sort of a funny little epilogue to this thing, but it could have been that they wanted to come down and assure me that that wasn't the case, that we're actually good, you know? And then, of course, I have the big question in my mind, why do I think the cover was so profound? I would love to be there when the cover was designed and someone's just literally artistically making choices. Why don't you just make their head flat? You know, everyone makes their head fat. We're just throwing this thing together. It's not based on any eyewitness testimony. It's just something cool. And then I could just breathe a sigh of relief that somehow my brain just preferred that alien design, right? And so instead of thinking and feeling, it was a more guttural feeling to my being, right? Now, the other weird thing is that whole idea that, and I know that some of you have had this, where you go to sleep and you close your eyes, and I've talked to a lot of my friends about this, and they've had it happen at least half a dozen times in a lifetime, where you shut your eyes. This hasn't happened to me in decades, but you shut your eyes and then you immediately wake up. And I used to have this a lot as a kid, just as sort of a fantasy story in my brain. I thought, well, maybe that's the day that things happened, you know, that I'm just literally shut down. But it's kind of weird how it happens. Like your memory is erased to the moment. Well, let's just erase everything for the moment he closed his eyes, the minute he opened his eyes, just in case, right? Like the Back to the Future little wand thing, right? Now, Dr. Greer, I'm going to give you, I don't have the guy's name, but Dr. Greer has a real interesting story that he, and it's sort of hard to believe, that he would choose to create this UFO group, and then he said he was grabbed by the Pentagon and brought in and supposedly debriefed, and they said, you're going to be the one that breaks the story to everyone. And he made I believe his movie's called Sirius. I apologize if I have that wrong, but it's a video that kind of pulls together all these testimonies. And then they have this little tiny fetus thing that looks like a little alien. And the official story on it, official, was actually a human fetus. But there were various attributes about it when they did autopsy on it that sort of suggest, well, if it is, then there's some weird, there's extra weird things about it. The way the eye was built, with some of the internal chambers of the head was built, it's definitely a living thing. It's not some, you know, sculpture or something. But the other part of the Disclosure Project, there's two pieces I want to give to you. I suggest if you're on YouTube, just go up there and search on Disclosure Project. Most of you have clicked on this have probably already seen their stuff and digested most of their videos. But there's a conference when they announced the project, and they actually had just a ton of guys from the government come up, give their story, and say they're willing to testify in a court of law that what they're saying is true. If you take inventory of what they're saying, there's probably 90% of them don't actually say that they had any personal contact with aliens, that they just had heard things and witnessed other people claiming things that that, you know, got them thinking about the aliens might be real. And then you have, during that press conference, someone, I believe from like a British paper, asked one of the guys who had just said that, he said, well, look, you know, I've personally seen, I think he said a number like 27 different species of aliens. And he goes, a lot of them could pass for human beings and they're among us right now. Very intriguing story. And I actually think that we're aliens. I mean, like, if there are aliens, we are them. I think the Homo sapien blasting out of the evolutionary chain away from the hominids and having articulated nasal canals, having visual cortexes that are several orders of magnitude more dense and big than other creatures, even though most of it's turned off, right? Our visual cortex seems to be turned off, which is interesting. The guy said, well, tell us. You say there's 27. Give us some examples of what they look like. And the guy unbelievably fumbled his answer. Now, he just said he saw them. So you would think that if you had 27 in your brain, that you could at least come up with 5 or 6 different ones, right? The guy just says, well, there's like gray ones, and then there's like, you know, Nordic-looking white people, like what I look like, but they're really tall, and he just fumbled the answer. And at that point, I thought, well, you're lying. You're just like those guys that get on Coast to Coast AM radio, and you say you've seen all this shit. As soon as the interview goes one step further into, what did you see? They just crumble. There's a guy that always gets on Coast to Coast. We love Coast to Coast, just so you know. I've actually been a subscriber several times in the past to their website, which is actually kind of fun. There's just not enough content for me to continue subscribing. If they would jack it up a little bit more, I'd be in there. But they'll have a guy that comes on. He says he's traveled to different planets and spent, as a military project, he just literally usurped the third act of Close Encounters. And he says he's one of the red suit guys that got on the spaceship and took off and spent, you know, from half a year to a couple of years over there. And he has all of his buddies. And this is a guy that says that, you know, Barack Obama went with him. Right. If someone else was president, they would have been the guy to go with him, right? So he says he spends months in a foreign planet with foreign aliens. When they asked him, what did you see? A caller, I think, kicked off the question. What did you see when you were there? That guy couldn't describe anything. You know, he was just so nebulous. It was as if he never contemplated someone asking him the details of his claims. And so I think that these guys get on there and they romanticize up these stories and then they fall apart. Okay. So I think that guy's a bona fide liar. And there's a bunch of them that have been interviewed that just, again, sweat bullets the second that the details come up. But there's a soldier in one of these videos. And again, if you've seen these, you've seen this video. And I apologize, I don't have the guy's name to throw at you. But there was a testimony, I believe, that happened in Chile, where they said that a flying saucer came out, was hit by radar, and crashed into the side of a mountain. And this soldier gives the testimony of being one of the crews that's not supposed to be a UFO recovery unit. They just were a unit to go check out a crashed vehicle. What if it was a, you know, Russian something or other, right? He says he sees a flying saucer really embedded in the side of a mountain, has these weird engines coming out of it. It's dripping this gooey fluid out of the back. And he says that he came up to it, and one of the things he said, the whole crew that came up was sort of excited and panicked about it at the same time. And he said once they got into a certain halo, a glow around it, you know, not light, but just a certain region around it, that they started feeling peaceful. He said that he felt like they were in there, and they were alive, and they were safe, but they just sort of made everyone feel cool. And they start trying to clean up the event, and then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, comes a bunch of man-made vehicles with men in them. They're this weird sort of independent A-team squad that takes care of alien crashed units, and they start really getting angry with him and his colleagues for daring to try to clean this thing up. You know, they weren't trying to break any rules. If its story is true, they weren't trying to break any rules. And so they actually took him, arrested him, held him for like 12 to 14 hours, debriefing him, threatening him if he ever said anything, and he's just like, he's a good old boy. It's his testimony that seems to be one of the most solid verbal reenactments of what he saw that I've ever seen in my life. And there was no ticks that I ever could find in his testimony, physical ticks, where I think he thought he was bullshitting the camera. He might just either be a fantastic liar. If it's not true, he's either a fantastic liar, I mean fantastic, or he was brainwashed to say this, meaning he believes it's true, or he's simply telling the truth. And it was a very fascinating story. Now, again, it seems odd that a space vehicle crashes into a mountain, but you know, maybe they have problems. Now, on the subject of crashed vehicles, because I'm going to get into plasma energy, being confused for aliens. You know, the idea that the Roswell crash, which has supposedly this explosion that happens inside the vehicle, for any of you who've worked in technology, physical technology, building or designing jets or rockets or anything like that, but even software technology, there's obviously extreme amount of testing that happens. And then you actually deploy whatever you've built and you use it. And then there's more bugs found and you constantly weed out the bugs until you've got a perfect system. So this idea that these flying saucers invariably have crashing problems is sort of really hard to believe, you know? Doesn't mean it couldn't happen, but I mean, man, they're flying in the most fragile test craft that's ever been designed, right? They're able to travel between dimensions or between galaxies or whatever, but they can't avoid crashing. And they are susceptible, this is what's interesting, they're susceptible to man-made things like radar. That was the first story behind Roswell, that the reason why it fell out of the sky was due to radar. Now, some people say lightning bolt. And I have to say, okay, so lightning bolts and radars are minuscule amounts of electricity and radio frequency waves that you would experience in the cosmos within seconds. You know, go through our Van Allen belts. It's way more intense than any radar we've ever built on Earth times, I don't know, a trillion. I mean, it's very, very powerful. Now, Stephen Greer came out recently and said, and I say recently, maybe the last 5 years, and he's reenacted the story because there was a problem with the Roswell story that they said that it was shot out of the sky from radar. Now, I don't know why anyone needs to explain why it flew out of the, why it crashed. Just say it crashed. Just leave it alone, right? But Dr. Stephen Greer got on and said that it was a more advanced radar than anyone's ever seen, 1947. And supposedly in the 60, 70 years since it happened, we haven't eclipsed in the declassified realm this radar that supposedly knocked this thing out of the sky. According to Bob Lazar, which we'll get into in a little bit, he got a job at Area 51, was then moved down to S4, and he was trying to reverse engineer antimatter engines out of one of the disks that was recovered that had no damage on it. But that he said he saw up to 9 others in the room with physical designs. He said one would look like the sports car. That's what he called it, and it didn't look like a sports car, but it's more sporty in shape. And, well, you know, some of them have big dents in it, like they've been hit by things. You know, if the story was like, hey, we found these in the ground after digging up the earth, and we did find that maybe the agents that brought us humanity, that'd make more sense to me. But they always have this U.S. military superiority thing that goes along with these stories, that we protected our people by shooting it out of the sky. And I bring us to that point for one very specific example of how much power the United States military has by making you believe that they have the capability of shooting these out of the sky. And that for some reason, out of all the governments in the world, the United States military is the only one that's admitted having I don't want to say they've admitted it, they haven't, but the people that want to tell these stories seem to only admit that the United States military is the only one to have not only one, but like 9 different ones. And those numbers fluctuate, so you might have heard 12, you might have heard 5, whatever. I've heard 9. I believe it's from Bob Lazar. So if you feel like your government has that much power, well, that's interesting. You believe they have power. And when you're a little child and you believe a magician is actually doing things because they're magical, then you believe that human being is imbued with interesting power like the Force, right? So I find that interesting. And now the UFOs are being used to validate the moon missions, of which never occurred. You know, they occurred, but we didn't go to the moon. And you can watch all my other stuff on the moon, but there's very specific reasons why we didn't go. But now astronauts who are tired of lying walk in the room and they say, well, you know, what the big problem is that we saw alien stuff up there. We were chased by them when we went up there, and we saw stuff on the moon, and there's supposedly bases on the dark side of the moon. And John Lear, the descendant of the Lear Jet Company, who's friends with Bob Lazar, you know, he'll take all these weird, blurry photographs of the moon, and you know, every little bump and anomaly, it's a road, it's a storage tank, it's a factory, and they're huge, and there's that spaceship that's been supposedly, you know, moved, rubbed out of the shots. And they're just basically chasing pixel artifacts and photographs and saying that there's something, right? Or just looking at natural formations and saying these can't be natural and they obviously have to be man-made or alien-made, intelligently made. And you know what? Maybe they're right, but, you know, whatever. But what that does is when an astronaut walks in and says it's all alien stuff up there, and that's the reason why, you know, it's a little murky in the truth of the moon missions. It validates the moon missions immediately. So it's no more fighting the science that NASA's trying to figure out right now with Project Orion to put humans in a capsule and get them through the Van Allen belts without dying. That's what Project Orion's all about. So NASA's kind of indirectly claimed that they didn't go to the moon by even in conceiving of the Orion project, right? Just go watch the trailer on the Orion project that NASA created, and it wouldn't be necessary if we already flew through the Van Allen belts with human tissue. They've already done the first experiment without publishing the results, which is they put an unmanned probe supposedly through just the very cusp of the Van Allen belts to see what happened to the vehicle. So hats off to NASA for trying to figure out how to do this, right? They're not evil people anymore like they used to be. You could argue that they take money out of our pockets for projects that maybe aren't happening, but they're really trying to do decent stuff with it in the end, right? And I'm sure they're connected to covert stuff that's not great, but there's definitely a contingency, I believe, that's doing the right thing. So let's get into plasma energy real quickly here, because it, I believe, is a very natural occurring thing that happens in planet Earth. Tesla was teaching us before he died that the Earth is actually a plasma electrical interior, and that one of the things he did with his antennas was to put a little bit of energy down, and he would suck as much out of the ground as he needed, or as we needed, to power everything that we have. We also have a lot of knowledge about the sun now being very electrical, and all the cosmologists, the leading cosmologists of our planet right now, are throwing away all the Newtonian physics, and they're remapping the entire universe as an electrical object, and now all of a sudden spiral galaxies make sense, gravity makes sense, the cyclical relationship we have with the sun makes sense, life makes sense. You know, and you're going to have to research some of this stuff, or I'm going to have to, you know, to wait for me to research it more so I can teach it in a different show. But it's interesting. But plasma energy is an ample supply at the center of the Earth, and every once in a while some of it pops out. And this is sort of common knowledge. But the place it pops out the most is in the deserts, where you have big giant rock surfaces that are exposed with very little plant life on them. And they shift, right? You know, the world's expanding. You should look up expanding Earth. It's the way the world works. And they used to teach it up to about 62 until they realized it was going to start exposing fossil fuel problems with, you know, the theory of fossil fuel and oil, right? Which I'll have to get into in a different episode. But out pops a very violently spinning piece of plasma energy. And it's much bigger than we get out of, like, say, ball lightning. A lot of people have seen ball lightning. My grandfather saw ball lightning once during the summertime. For those of you who didn't grow up in the Midwest in Kansas or some tornado-ridden area of the world, one of the things that we're told when a tornado comes through town is you open up all your windows, because the negative pressure on the outside, or the negative pressure on the inside and the outside, fluctuates in your house, can literally explode if a tornado were to suck all the oxygen away from your house during the cyclone phase when it goes by your home, and your home will explode. That's why a lot of homes disappear completely. It's not just the tornado wiping you off physical force. It's creating a negative explosion, which gives the first pop to all of its structure, and then the wind comes by and just cleans it all up. So my grandfather was opening all the windows because they had an alarm go through. And when he did, lightning bolt struck outside. And he said a ball lightning about the size of a softball comes zipping in the room, and it had a sound to it, like a real metallic ringing sound. He said it bounced through and he hit four or five appliances in the kitchen. He said he had a teapot right in front of him up on the, we had a stove and then like a little 6-inch relief and then the kitchen table. And it bounced and hit this coffee pot. And he said it just hovered for a split second and then it went boom right out the window. Again, I think it may be an electrical path that is maybe perhaps opposites attract sort of pathfinding, right? He was very happy he didn't touch it because he thought, man, this thing is pure electricity, man. It'll just kill you in 2 seconds, right, or 2 milliseconds. So what happens with this plasma energy is it goes up in the air and it's spinning. And depending on its mass and depending on its velocity of spin, you get either a round ball or you might get a disc. And when you observe it with your eye, light is bouncing off this thing just like chrome, right? So life is hitting it. Photons go in and plasma energy will reject it wholeheartedly, right? And you'll see a sphere and it's chrome. And then you have those stories that we always see, and there's videos of it too, where these things zip off in directions and do these right angle turns. Very similar to the ball lightning that my grandfather saw in the kitchen. Now imagine the atmosphere is charged due to a storm, or not charged due to an empty sky, because this thing just pops out of the ground with no storm having to be the catalyst to its existence. And then you might have negative pressures or various anomalies in the Earth that you can't see, right? We've talked about the Earth has meridian lines of electricity, and we believe that ancients knew all about this. The Giza Plateau seems to be built on a meridian. Paris is built on a meridian. London is built on a meridian. So there's a lot of rock formations in America where these Native Americans, or the fabled tall people that the Native Americans talk about, would construct these walls on the meridians to absorb their power and potentially use it. I don't know. But these things could have anomalies in the sky that relate to electricity that cause them to fly in these different directions. And of course, because light's bouncing off of them and we could see them to be chrome, we've got videos of this all over the web. Some of them, most of them, are that's plasma energy, and the other ones say it's UFO. Could be that it absorbs too and makes it look a little bit dark. I don't know. But when they team up in the sky, there's four or five of them, there might be an anomaly in the ground that's ejecting these things in the sky. And because it's like in a conveyor belt of pushing rock, right? It might go pop, 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 and knock a bunch of these in the sky in a big line. And they're just sitting up there extremely bright at night, extremely chrome during the day. And then they might all one by one disappear because they've simply run out of their energy. They diffuse. But some of them might zip around the sky as well. And they're going to block the shit out of radar. So the Navy's not telling a lie when they say we've seen these things fly 4,000 miles an hour, 20,000 miles an hour across the sky. And what could possibly do that besides an intelligent vehicle? Now, Whitley Strieber actually put forth an interesting idea, and maybe you probably grabbed it from someone else, that grays look insect-like to us because they have almond eyes, and they may have insect interiors, which totally contradicts all these fake autopsies we see. And that can actually withstand these incredible pressures. And I'm going to guarantee if you take an ant inside of a vehicle and move it 20,000 miles an hour one direction from zero, that ant's going to be pate inside that vehicle no matter how insect-like he is, right? But I want you to consider that some of the stuff we're seeing, it may be very, very normal. And I'm going to go back into plasma in 1 second here, but I'm going to give you a little anecdote. My grandmother... I have two sets of grandparents. They're all gone now. But one set of grandparents was 10 years older than the other. So my grandmother on my side of the family, on my surname side of the family, she actually, probably when I was about, I don't know, 21, 22, she said she, as a child, which would have been about 1920, and with her sisters, they would sit in the Kansas Plains and look out over the plain and see these cigar-shaped what appeared to be vehicles in the sky, very dark, kind of brownish to the eye, and they had like smoke coming out of the back of them, and they were going in the opposite direction of the smoke as if that was a propulsion unit. And she said it to me in a way that was kind of like, I can't believe I'm telling you this. She's never told me any other tale remotely like that at all. Everything was just normal. This is your relatives. This is where, you know, where we worked, all that kind of stuff. Never told me anything crazy. And she almost told me with wandering eyes, you know, when someone's kind of like a little embarrassed to say something, it's also a tribute if someone lies, but she was gaining nothing from this conversation at all from me. It wasn't like I didn't even get tremendously excited at the time because it was such an offshoot thing she was telling me. I wasn't prepared for it. We were actually going through old photographs as I was trying to figure out, you know, what all the families were in our family tree before she passed away. So she tells me this, and I started doing the math on it. I thought, well, it can't be any vehicles that we actually had in the sky. You know, we had hot air balloon technology probably way back in the 1800s, maybe even before that. That, you know, some of the Peruvian drawings in the desert, they think they might have mastered hot air balloons. It's not hard to find out that, you know, we put your hand over a fire, something's pushing up, and if you were to drape a cloth over it, it's starting to make a bubble in the cloth, and someone could figure out that you could maybe fly in it. But this didn't match any of that. And what's interesting is since she told me the story, I, you know, was able to go on the internet and look up cigar-shaped flying vehicles, and they're it's part of the theory of everything out there when it comes to UFOs especially, right? So I think that was interesting. Another anecdote before we go back to plasma. A friend of mine who we've actually had on this show, his father... was a test pilot way back when. My friend's 71 years old, so just imagine his father being a test pilot in the 40s and 50s and 60s. said he was up doing some atmospheric flying in a test vehicle. And he said, I think it was about 60,000 feet or so. And he said that a 28 to 30 foot vehicle or something came up to his craft, and it had sort of like that pulsing electricity around the outside edge. It gave the illusion that it was spinning, but after deeper concentration, he thought, well, it's probably just pulsing electricity giving it that disco-like movement feel to it, right? And it's very, very similar to some of the electrical fish we see in the deeper ocean where they fly around there. You know, they have sort of luminescent interiors. But he said this thing came up to him and hovered and freaked him out a little bit because he's thinking, man, if this thing bumps into me, I might die up here. I'm going really, really fast, really, really high up, and you can't have an anomalies in the pressure of the sky. And obviously a collision would just be immediately fatal, most likely. And the story didn't come out easily. The story came out where my buddy said, he goes, look, my father never really told me about much of what he did. And it wasn't because he was trying to hide necessarily. He just said, work is work and home is home. And I was going to leave work at home, or work at work, excuse me. And so he said it was very close to his father's death that he finally revealed this story to his son. His son's a genius, special effects guy, artist, musician. I mean, you know, he could, if anyone could socially and mentally handle such an outrageous story, it would be my buddy. And so I thought that was interesting that, again, a testimony from someone who was sort of reluctant to release that information gave it more credibility. You know, it's just sort of a mathematical thing to say, well, these people aren't tall tale stories. Tellers, right? Storytellers. So I have a couple of those little anecdotes in my life that make me think, okay, even if I don't think that that the government has really captured all these vehicles and that maybe Bob Lazar is either not really doing what he's doing or doing what he's doing, there definitely appears to be either other residents of this planet or visitors from someplace else. Plasma energy. Let's go back. Now, before I give you the last tale about plasma, I want to tell you about something a lot of you UFOlogists have seen. You know this better than me, but NASA did a little experiment when they figured out the Van Allen belts were a huge electrical pole around Earth created by its plasma core. They'll tell you it's nickel, but it's plasma. That they took the space shuttle out and they released this really long wire out the back of the space shuttle. And I've heard varying lengths of 5 miles to, you know, several hundred feet. But for whatever reason, it's on video. And NASA's recoiling this wire and figuring out how much electricity they can grab. And what I was told by my uncle, who was following this very intensely at the time, was that so much electricity came back from this wire instantaneously that it fried the coupling mechanism that was the metal that was hanging onto the wire, and so that it snapped off and started floating off. Now, for me, thinking about it again, I thought, well, what are they going to do, reel it back in and take it home? Want to just leave it in space or let it fry up on reentry? But that's not important. What's important is the video kept rolling of this whole thing, and as soon as this wire went out there, you have this video of a bunch of swimming fish-like looking. They're little discs, and they appear to be swimming. I mean, sorry, they appear to be spinning really fast. And they're in the camera, floating around. And, of course, NASA said, okay, that's just a bunch of, dirt in the atmosphere inside the space shuttle getting in between the lens and the window to film outside. Then somebody said, well, the camera was outside. It wasn't inside. So I'm not quite sure I can explain that. Maybe space dust coming off the vehicle or whatever. But then people started doing analysis of the video and started saying, well, this thing's actually going behind, you know, some of the space shuttle's arms and that kind of stuff, going behind the wire that's floating out there. And it's very, very intriguing, these kind of flying disc-looking things. And it could simply be an indigenous creature that lives in the upper atmosphere. We think that life has to be like us, and it doesn't have to be like us at all, right? There are bacteria that live at the bottom of the ocean next to big volcanic plumes that actually are puking out, you know, cyanide gas, and these bacteria live fine at thousands of degrees heat, and they can be in acidic things that kill mankind, but they're fine. And I believe they find these off the coast of Hawaii, where it's creating the new island there, you know. Now, a couple of interesting things about these flying disc things. One, the discs appear to be perfectly circular and flat, except they have a little notch out of them. And the notch never seems to be rotating. Now, there's two explanations I could think of real quickly. One, it's spinning so quickly, like that when you're driving by a car and you look down at its wheel, it's spinning. It just appears to be, when it spins about 60 frames a second to the brain, it looks like it's stationary. So it could be that it's spinning at the perfect interval, so man's eyeball and the camera thinks it's still, or it's like those luminescent fish where it has a spinning electrical signal, even in its bladder, even in the center of it, that makes it appear like it's rotating, but it's really the electrical force of these creatures that could be living off the ionosphere, or off the, Van Allen belt layers that give it that pulsating thing. It metabolizes perhaps the electrons to live. Why not? We're all electric, right? I guess they could metabolize and eat it and maybe make it like a photosynthesizing relationship for their biomatter. Now, I believe, I'm not going to name the region of the world that this happened, but there was a region of the world where a very primitive race had created these discs. I think they made them out of brass or something like that, out of some metal. And they looked exactly like the discs that are in the sky with this little notch. The notch is very specific in shape. And someone had made these discs, and there were essentially some cave scrolls, on the wall and stuff, and even on the discs, I believe, that suggested that these were mocking some sort of alien life, which is interesting, right? These discs were analyzed and then stolen by some like Smithsonian group, So you can see photos of them, but you can't actually see the real ones. But if you look up, artifact, disc, alien, you'll probably find these things. I mentioned that because there's a visual correlation there that the videos that I've seen haven't quite pieced these two together, at least that I've seen. I'm sure someone's done it, but I just hadn't seen it myself. Now, I promised this next section was about plasma. Well, there's a lot of NASA footage about these what appear to be disc-like objects going towards the Earth's atmosphere and then bouncing off and flying away. Well, they'll also change directions as they fly. But then there were, as part of this video, there seems to be a streak of electricity that flies out of the Earth and goes straight up. And then that seems to cause them to fly away from this sort of almost like an attack of some burst from the Earth. Now, that could be a natural anomaly coming from the Earth that under infrared filters we see. Maybe it's with the naked eye. Not quite sure what lens they were using on this thing. But I went to a party with some extremely brilliant people. And I sat down with this guy that was in the video game business. And he's very, very famous for one game that he still makes to this day. The game is no less than, I think, 20 years old now. But they keep releasing new versions of it. And he said, look, he totally believes in aliens completely. And I said, well, why do you believe in aliens? And he goes, well, it's actually a weird story. He goes, in the late 80s, I had mastered 3D rendering, 3D technology for architectural purposes, for design purposes. And he goes, I made a lot of money before I got into video games creating 3D renderings of new covert weapons that the military was actually developing. And he said that the last one that he worked on was a plasma cannon. And he said he visited one, he saw his designs realized, so he says, this isn't fake, I've been there, and this guy has no reason to lie to me at all. And he said that the way they do is they take a missile silo and take out the missile and get rid of it. And so you have this nice almost silo in the ground, right, with multiple levels because these rockets are really huge, right? And he said that every single level of this weapon, that they had these chemical dispensers all the way around, and that they would throw out this chemical gas into the center and ignite it, and it would be this huge plasma column of energy that due to its attraction to, obviously, negative pressure versus positive pressure would come hurling out of this thing and shoot a beam straight up in the sky. And he mentioned the NASA footage of these discs being diverted by these cannons. I mean, it looks like just like a stream of amazing electricity. And he said they were building this thing. And he goes, I don't know why they were building it. And he goes, the only thing I could come up with was that it was a weapon against alien, potentially, invasions. It was an experimental thing. Now, after I talked to him, it kind of dawned on me that something that's fixed in the Earth, it's a silo, it's not aimable, right? It's just, you better be straight up above the silo to hit it. But maybe it's just, this is the test apparatus to get it going. And maybe it's just a test to create plasma weapons that are going to be in barrels eventually and you can point them. But again, to my knowledge, I've never heard anyone rumor that we have plasma cannons, right? We definitely have probably some sort of directed energy weapons, as Rumsfeld has confirmed after 9/11. Some of us think that those were used to help liquidate the World Trade Centers for very, very specific scientific reasons, not because we want to believe that. So I thought that was very, very interesting that they had, one, identified plasma energy as a potential source of use. And he said that when he visited the facility, that the individuals in the silo were just sweating bullets 24/7. He said, this thing is so new and so experimental and so absolutely dangerous that if it goes wrong, we all die immediately. We don't necessarily die the best death on planet Earth. We're getting fried alive. And to my knowledge, no mistake has ever occurred. But that was one of the stories that came out of it. So do aliens exist? I'm going at it from a UFO standpoint. I'm going at it from an alien life standpoint. I think it's painfully obvious that obviously aliens exist. We know this for a fact, that there's definitely life out there. Unless we're sitting inside of a Truman computer, and even if it was a Truman computer, why not make more creatures and have them kind of interact with each other and find out how they interact with each other? I think it's pretty obvious. Now, there's been a lot of experiments by ufologists that say that, and especially like NASA, where they're trying to dismiss this belief. And I don't know why anyone would ever try to dismiss this belief, but they try to rewind the universe back to this ridiculous story of the Big Bang. And then they try to create a timetable of who would be the first to have access to intelligent life. And then based on that discovery of perhaps warp speed, in effect, the guys really never give them the qualification of having warp speed. I think the example goes up to warp speed, that they wouldn't have enough time to get from their planet to our planet for us to ever meet them, right? And I think that there's lunacy all through that theory, right? The idea that, one, that you cannot travel the speed of light or travel faster than your speed of light. It was just a recent article where someone said they think they can do it, that somehow that's a limiter, and that there can't be some hyperspace jumping. There can't be some interdimensional travel mechanism. So it's sort of a frivolous exercise, but it's someone trying to get us to not believe that there are creatures out there that also have intelligence. And I think it's strange that why would the government go into this big exercise, unless the guy's just trying to write a thesis paper for his PhD. I think it injures the mind. Now, let's talk about the social elements of aliens, and then I'm going to loop back to part of my evolution episode, which is number 2, which talks about aliens potentially cross-splicing us, right? We have aliens coming out of eyewitness testimonies from individuals, from people saying they're being abducted, actually looking into their eyes, to UFOs. Okay. And it seems to be pretty peaceful, Although there are some testimonies that came out of Roswell where people supposedly on their deathbed, and there's supposed to be hundreds of them, said, these things were creatures and they freaked me out, But you're also talking about an age of individuals that hadn't seen all of these space sci-fi movies like Super Troopers? That's a different film. But Star Troopers, right? Where you have these bugs that are tearing people apart, and of course all the alien movies, and, where it's like bad alien. We've allowed the whole idea of aliens to be demonized. Even Prometheus gets to a point where they've built up this really interesting reincarnation of an alien race, and then what does he do? He gets mad in the third act and kills everybody. I mean, it's just, it's good for action, I guess, but in terms of engaging the human mind and pushing it forward like 2001 Space Odyssey, you have a senseless bloodbath at the end of a movie. And I don't know, he's going to go off and he's doing the sequel to Prometheus right now. Ridley Scott is. And I just think it's fascinating. What could he do? Is he going to be more angry people wherever he goes, sort of thing, right? But the story of Star Trek by Gene Roddenberry, with his prime directive not to touch a planet until they hit warp, I think is very fascinating, and that there would be definitely probably some rules in place. And I say this because man has thought of Star Trek. And when we think about aliens dropping off and touching Earth and not coming in and getting rid of our corrupt leaders that hurt us with all these horrible food supplies that are destroying us and the crappy air and the crappy water, that it seems hard to believe that they wouldn't step in to at least covertly knock some of these guys out of power, right? But maybe there is. And I push that forward because in all the fictional stories of Star Trek, you have them always faced with the dilemma episode about every season. You have this dilemma episode where someone's suffering badly due to their current government or their current people, and they end up walking away. They go, like, we can't intervene. If someone gets captured from the Star Trek story, they always kind of break the rules, bend the rules, and get in and get their guys out. But overall, they try not to contaminate the timeline of these individuals. They tend to walk away. And I think that might, if we could think of that in a fictional sense in Hollywood, why wouldn't a creature that's figured out how to travel not have the same principles? I don't think they're all just insects, reptilians coming to rip us apart and eat us, right? Now, I'm going to get into Planet X here for a split second, because the Hollywood story of aliens bad tends to carry itself and sort of the current thinking of some of the most edgy theories about where aliens are. And if you're not familiar with the Planet X theory, you have this mini solar system with a sun that's called Nemesis and a key planet called Nibiru. And there's other planets in this thing, but Nibiru is where supposedly, according to the story, our ancestors come from. Our indigenous ancestors were hominids, not human, and so they were more like monkeys. You know, they had monkey cavities in their skulls, which I talk about in the evolutionary episode. And Homo sapiens' big advancement in the missing link. You know, we're taught as children in America that the missing link is like a bone. You know, there's like one evolutionary bone that explains the fact that the man had empty nasal cavities that would let us howl but not articulate, like I'm talking to you right now. And one jump, we have fully articulated upright rib cages and essentially a skeleton that looks similar to an amphibian, like some sort of monkey or something, but isn't human-like, right? So a lot of anthropologists say there's not a single bone of Homo sapien that's in hominid or hominid and Homo sapien. Even though they look similar and structurally are very connected the same way, they're not the same. All right. I'll take the expert's word on that, right? And I've seen the x-rays and stuff and the bone skeletons and stuff, so they have a point, right? But there appears to be a tremendous amount of evidence where, and the evidence it can be substantiated because we don't have alternate explanations of how the advancement in Homo sapien came about so quickly. If carbon dating is correct, and again, it's all the science that they bullshit us about that actually makes the alien theory of being seeded pop out a little bit more intense. But now that this Planet X Nibiru relationship is trying to explain it. But I want to take you down the line of the thinking, because the same people who wrote that story wrote some really, I think, ignorant passages in the story. Now, like religion, everything that's fictional is created that's trying to forge a belief system tends to emulate man at that time, right? What do I mean by that? Well, religion tends to have metaphors that are very specific to the way that man believed at the time. Whatever was valuable is considered valuable. Whatever is not valuable is not valuable. For instance, you know, the Roswell crash being blamed on radar. Well, radar was a new technology, and it seems like sci-fi. The radar itself seemed science fiction-oriented to people who didn't understand the basic mathematics of bouncing radar from getting a signature back, right? So they use that as the explanation for the Roswell crash, and I think that we can all kind of relax and go, yeah, that's probably not right, right? There's more radioactive waves the second you fly into space, even just high atmosphere, than there's in a man-made radar, right? But the one thing that I always hear is that aliens want our resources. They want gold. That's a big one. And the Planet X theory is all based on their acquisition of gold. And they've come up with this ridiculous story that the atmosphere of Nibiru actually needs gold to reseed it to be life-giving. Now, they're saying that it was supposed to arrive in April and May, and because of its gravitational force, it's supposed to throw all of our planets out of whack. It's supposed to throw our poles off and sort of flip Earth around, really strange. Because of its gravitational relationship to our solar system, it's going to attract a lot of meteorites are going to come in and hit off the coast of Scotland. But the way they got this information, for one, is by psychically talking to people in Nibiru, right? All right. It's not like I don't believe that we have thought that could be tangibly derived from trying to hear each other's thoughts. You know, they have this experiment where they push two foreheads together for 25 minutes, and then they can go into RF-proof rooms, and they can still hear each other's thoughts. And so, if you have to go to Vegas and cheat for a day, try touching foreheads for 25 minutes before you go. But this Nibiru story is that they came to Earth to splice together from hominid, Homo sapien, and then they were immediately created to make a slave race, to forge gold out of the Earth, to give it to the Nibiru people, that before the Nibiru planet swings out of orbit with us, that they're going to fly over to Earth, make all this stuff happen, splice human beings and hominids together, whatever their DNA is with ours, and make humans, right? Using the indigenous, you know, mouth-breathing, fully qualified evolutioned indigenous beings to then just give them more intelligence so they can do what the Nibiru people want. And supposedly the Nibiru people look very humanoid. They're the ones that are sort of the Easter Island, you know, Caucasian bearded people, which we actually have a lot of artifacts in South America of white people all over the place, which is really strange. It just happens to be fact. But regardless, now you take the timing of this whole thing. We're going to get back to resource management in a second. But the timing of this is that supposedly this planet comes into orbit around Earth for a very short period of time. It would be here and gone within a couple of years of our particular lifetime. Now you think about the average scientific experiment, no matter how brilliant you are, to splice two beings together and to go through a phase where you got a bunch of bad ones that pop out, a bunch of good ones that pop out, but you're going to have to wait for them to grow up physically in order to see what they do, and then you need to teach them what you need them to do. So this idea that Nibiru stopped by and within a flash of a second was able to completely re-engineer hominids to be humanoid, or to be a non-humanoid, but Homo sapien, and then give them the charge to dig a bunch of gold out of the ground, then do that, which is going to take, I don't know, several hundred, if not thousands of years, to give them enough to reseed their atmosphere, that the whole theory breaks down. And it seems to be a story that goes back enough decades that would be what man would appreciate as a good story. Well, of course, everybody wants gold. I want gold right now. It's because it seems to be the big deal in our society today to value money and to make sparkly things to put around our necks, right? I think those stories injure our consciousness for accepting aliens into our life. And I can only assume that if they really existed, if that thing that happened to me during your Christmas was real, they're reaching into my mind to say, what do you think about us? And to the degree that you think okay, then maybe we'll go to the next guy and see if he thinks it's okay. But if they start finding housewives freaking out over mice in a kitchen, and aliens are going to be the one thing that just tears their consciousness into complete shreds until they're in a funny farm bumping up against a padded room, then they're not going to show up because it's going to be too much. And the fact that we are now creating one movie after another where everything that's alien that shows up is bad, well, we're reversing our consciousness to go backwards, right? And Nibiru doesn't help, okay? Nibiru comes with a bunch of physical anomalies that's going to destroy Earth with meteorites, flip our poles around, all this other kind of stuff. And then, of course, there's evil people on Nibiru that want to make us slaves. Now, when I think about aliens going after gold, I always go back to that Twilight Zone. I forgot its name. I apologize. But it's the old original Twilight Zones, where a bunch of bank robbers steal a bunch of gold bars, and they have this little outfit set up in the desert where it's a little cave. And they're going to essentially go into stasis with their gold in this cave with their truck. And they are going to hide for 100 years and then pop out. And then no one will know who they are. They've got this gold, and they could sell it and be rich. Fairly decent idea. But they go in this cave, and of course they're in these glass containers so we can see them asleep for visual television storytelling reasons, but a rock hits one of them and cracks it, and then one guy dies. They're in a cave with glass things. Come on. It's pretty obvious that's going to happen. They wake up, and long story short, all but one survived because of the interpersonal conflicts of greed, where one guy basically wants to steal from all the rest. And the head honcho, I guess, she gets bumped off as well. But the last scene in this Twilight Zone is all you need to hear to remind yourself of how insane it is that aliens would want to have something to do with our precious materials. And we'll get into fusion in 1 second. But the guy at the very end, he's almost dead. In fact, he's just a couple of breaths from death. And what he really needs is a glass of water, because he's been just emaciated by the sun, and he's murdered his two buddies. He finally makes it to a highway, and here comes the vehicle from Forbidden Planet that Robbie the Robot drove. It's got two humans in it, no Robbie the Robot, and he drives up, and the guy gives him the bar, because he is 100 years in the future, and he gives him this bar of gold, and he goes, here, you can have this bar of gold if you just give me a glass of water. And then the guy dies. And the guy is a husband and wife inside this thing, fictionally speaking. And the husband walks back up to the vehicle, and his wife is like, well, what, is he okay? You know, is this, what did he want? And he goes, it's really weird. I think he says he died, but he goes, look, he gave me this bar of gold as if it had value because he just wanted a glass of water. And the beautiful tale of that is that in the future, either we've devalued gold as this shiny object that we need to have, or potentially by using fusion, which is where you can actually craft atoms out of base components to be whatever you want them to be, regardless of how much energy it takes to do it. Because 0 point energy, all matter on Earth is going to be very easy to create. Anything. You want to make uranium? No problem. You want to make gold? No problem. It's just like Doc in Back to the Future comes back at the end of the film, and he's stuffing all the trash in the back of his DeLorean because he has this kind of blender in the back that will fusion it into energy for his flux capacitor, right? But we have to assume that anyone that could travel interstellarly, and even Nibiru swinging by Earth, you still got to make a trip off Nibiru to Earth, and you have to bring a shit ton of scientific equipment. And I guess the theory is that maybe they took it back. No one ever addresses the logistics of why haven't we found a laboratory of aliens here, of alien stuff. It doesn't pan out, and it's not valuable to our exploration of space, you know. The other one is that we look into space to try to find radio waves, thinking that the way we found intelligence through electronics is the way that an alien's going to find the same intelligence. And I guess they're actually going to start up another SETI here shortly to try and see if they can't find, another species of alien. But we're trying to find intelligent radio transmissions in space, which I think is a stretch if there ever was one. And supposedly a wave is actually going to make it completely across the universe, undisturbed, unchattered, white noised out, so that we can hear alien television. Will we even know what it sounds like? They're looking for binary bits and that kind of stuff. And of course, everyone knows the story about when supposedly a binary star is found that we thought it was intelligent life, and it happened to be a rotating mass that had a bunch of electrons spitting out on one end. And so when you continually rotate it, you're getting spit in the face at a particular rotation, so it seems intelligent. All right, so those have been dismissed. So this episode's about, do aliens exist? And I think that the answer is, emphatically yes. I guess the big question is, have we bumped into them? One of the guys that says that he, like I said, Bob Lazar, very interesting story on this guy. I'm convinced Bob Lazar is either extremely bad liar or an extremely good liar. What does that mean? Well, his whole story is that he worked at S4 reverse engineering this antimatter engines that hang in the bottom of a UFO. And the way his theory goes is that the you have a disc, and they have these three to four different configurations where these hanging antimatter engines can actually tilt. And as they tilt, they shoot out this electromagnetic wave that actually disturbs gravity. And because we think gravity now is the old-fashioned theory of ether, A-E-T-H-E-R, that it actually would create a gravity bubble that would pull the vehicle in a particular direction. And so they could take this vehicle, move wherever they need to move using these antimatter engines. All right, whatever. When interviewed, the lineage behind Bob Lazar is that he popped out and made all these claims that he worked for Area 51 and S4, and that and to spite the government, he actually went around and started telling everyone the stuff was down there. Now, again, the psyop that could be going on is that, look how powerful the United States government is. We have all this stuff and you don't. And they have a guy that's going to tell a tall tale and make you believe it. But the pedigree behind him was that he did a bunch of lie detector tests. And the lie detector test passed, like a dozen lie detector tests. Now, what I've never seen is anyone who's done a on-camera testimony giving their lineage, giving lie detector tests, saying that Bob completely passed with flying colors. All I've ever heard is a few radio interviews, and it's just as undetailed as you could possibly be for one of the most amazing claims in mankind, that we've actually made contact with aliens. We have their ships and we're reverse engineering them. And coincidentally, they don't know where the ships are and they don't come back to get them. I think it's really strange, right? We would do that. That's what Star Trek does. And whatever Star Trek does is what we would do, because we're human beings that wrote that show. And to think that aliens supposedly lack, they're so primitive in mind that they can't do what we would do, which is a logical thing. Don't contaminate the timeline of mankind by dropping off a crashed vehicle. Come get it, you know? And you know, they're like these weird Magellan, you know, spaceships that just get lost from their people, right? They're just out here all by themselves. Where'd they go? Well, the Joneses, they went off to some planet called Earth and never came back, you know? Who cares, right? It's just, it's ridiculous. But anyway, Bob got in trouble because he this is something that I think is declassified and I think makes complete sense. He took himself and John Lear and a woman, I believe, up to this hill overlooking Area 51 when he knew some test flights were going to occur with some experimental vehicles. And all the eyewitness testimony said that I believe they did see some things take off and move around a little bit. I don't think the claim was that they moved in ridiculous ways, but I could be wrong. John Lear's given huge interviews on this. And then obviously because they're next to Area 51, they're getting in trouble because the feds show up and grab them. And there's this big tall tale that John Lear says about them getting arrested, which sounds fairly believable. Now, at that point, Bob Lazar is taken in for questioning about what he thinks he's doing. And he's told at that point, the way the Vance version of the story is, that he's told that his wife has been cheating on him with someone in his life. So they kind of take him down a few pegs, you know, to kind of destroy him mentally, and then they fire him. And so Bob had also taken measures that he knew he was kind of close to being terminated because he was playing on the edge, that he had taken a news reporter from, I believe, New Mexico or something, Arizona. I think it was Arizona television station, down to some relatively covert government places to validate that he actually worked there, showed him his identification, had the guy interview people to prove that Bob did have this covert job. And he's supposedly this massive physicist, this massive thinker. But that's where it gets really weird, because they interview him for hours online. You can just go look up interviews. There's one that's really famous where he's standing at a podium, standing up. And I believe if you look at the frame, he's over in the right side of the frame. And they ask him where he's from. They ask him where he went to school. And he can't remember. He can't remember a bunch of details about his life. And I think that's really weird. If I were in the same situation, I don't know why I would protect the fact that I went to school in the Midwest. You know, like, what? It's not the school that made me brilliant. It's me that made me brilliant. I took normal things out of the lexicon of knowledge, and I made it something that's special that got me the job. So there's no covert knowledge to really hide unless there's some Hogwarts somewhere that he's lying about, right? And there's no reason to believe that. So Bob pops out of this government thing, circles the world, makes a ton of cash, and he starts getting a lot of criticism on him because they start to find the holes in his story. And so he pulls out of actually doing interviews and creates a little website, which you can still find, I believe, where he sells a bunch of eclectic, weird electronics equipment. And just kits and weird stuff, right? Trying to, as he said, you know, stimulate scientific experimentation that might maybe lean towards some of the stuff he's seen. Now, right now, if you go to the website, you'll find the website, but you won't be able to buy anything. As soon as you put something in the cart and try to cash out, the site crashes. I did that about a year ago. And if you try to contact them, all the emails bounce, all this other stuff. Well, according to John Lear, Bob has gone back to work for these people because we can't really find the guy anymore. He's got a new girlfriend, new wife, or whatever. And then John tells a story. I'm kind of going between John Lear, who's supposed to be best friends with Bob, or was at one point. And he said that Bob actually told him something that I think was a little more believable and interesting, and that Bob actually was exposed to a gray alien. But what Bob actually did, which I think adds a little credibility back to him, was he said, you know what, I'm not sure this thing was real. He goes, I was taken down a hallway, and it was like one of these hazard glass doors. You know, it's a big security door, but you know, you can look through the hazard glass that has kind of the mesh of metal in it, so it can't be easily broken. And he pushed his face up against it, and there was a scientist in a white coat in a really like weird blue lit room. And the alien the gray is standing right next to him. And he goes, it didn't move. It didn't say anything. I didn't hear anything from it, like telepathic communication of any kind. So he goes, this thing looked like it was either a little mannequin, or if it was real, maybe it's genetically created something or other, like some Jekyll Island experiment where they maybe screwed with human DNA. You know, you got spider goats out there where they've done everything. You can assume, by the way, that every single possible experimentation with humanity and animals and insects has been done already. They have cross-spliced everything, probably horrifically so. And it's just because it's so horrific, they don't acknowledge they're going to do it, and they don't tell you what happens as a result of doing it. So who knows what pops out of those little experiments, that they might be able to create a race that looks really strange, but they're humanoid mixed with God knows what, right? So that's sort of where the story ends in my experiment with Bob Lazar. Now, let's kick this thing off at the end here with a very interesting story and some interesting evidence that suggests that the government might use the pretense of an alien invasion as a mechanism to make mankind come under one roof and do whatever the hell centralized government says globally. Now, a lot of you already know the story, but Werner von Braun is the Nazi that created the V1 and V2 rockets that bombed the living shit out of Europe and especially England. And then he was smuggled into America through Operation Paperclip and started NASA with, along with 1,200 of his buddies. Half of them went off to CIA to create MKUltra, which is what the show is affectionately named after. And the other ones went off to create NASA. All right. So the moon missions go their way. They're faked like hell. And von Braun essentially let go from NASA in 1974. This is the godfather of travel through space. If all the stories are correct, and he's let go from NASA. Why would you ever let go of the guy, right? I know Imagineers that helped build Disneyland and work for Walt Disney personally, and they are completely, they're still Imagineers today. They got the alumni card. They're celebrated more than you could possibly imagine. But Werner von Braun is like, ping, see you later. And he dies later in the 70s, right? Well, his receptionist has come out and said, and again, for me, this woman looks like, you know, a woman that would, just an appearance thing, and I apologize for judging the book by its cover, but for me, she looks like a person that would also read my palm and tell me the future, you know, kind of thing. But she has been very consistent in her story that Werner von Braun said, look, the other plan that's being hashed inside NASA and the upper levels of intelligence is that they want to do this alien invasion on Earth, or they're experimenting with the idea of if they could fake an alien invasion, basically build crafts, their anti-grav, and really convince people there's aliens coming in. If you build a weird race of crossbred humans with freaking insects or whatever, and they look strange, but they're totally healthy and they're okay, and they move around in a way that's intelligent, right? You could say that they're saying whatever they're saying. You know, if you built them, you could teach them a whole different world. You're aliens, you know? Okay, I'm from another planet. And then if you asked them, they'd say that, right? You could make up a fake language and teach them a fake language, a new language that they talk amongst themselves. But they would look completely alien, right? But he kept telling his receptionist this before he died, and she's gone out through the project disclosure with Stephen Greer, Dr. Stephen Greer, and has repeated this several times. Well, those of you who know about the Reagan speech, is something that he did right after getting into office, and the History Channel actually did a weird story about this. We're talking to the two presidential speechwriters at the time, saying that Reagan had come to them and said, why don't we tell this story that if aliens came down here, we'd all be united on one front, we'd have a new world order because we would come together as humanity and stop fighting. It's a beautiful idea, you know, if there weren't nefarious people running this planet. But the story goes is that they said, you know, don't say it. Don't say it. We're not going to put it in your speech for you to read. You know, don't do it. Now, for any of you who know how these speeches are written, there's also specials on how the presidential speeches are written. And if you ask your old fart who thinks that, well, newspapers tell you the complete truth, the videos go like this of people writing speeches. They're sitting in front of a monitor, two guys, and they're writing this letter, they're writing the speech together, usually. There's also two telephones in the room. And the telephones continually ring, and they continually do this. And it's on video. You can see this. They are talking to some shadow government official who's reading the word processor. So as they type, it's coming real time to some off camera location, and they're being crafted. They're being controlled by a shadow government individual, an agency that's saying, add that word, subtract that word, remove that sentence, add this sentence. So the speeches are heavily crafted. They're only given a basic architecture by the writers, by the typists, right? And someone else is controlling the major content. So if you have some ancillary stupid information that needs to be said, rah, rah, America, your local writers can handle that. But if you're talking about axis of evil, that kind of stuff, you're going to have these guys phoning it in and changing words. I've seen it. Okay. So you stitch a few of these things together, and then you have a bunch of weird stuff going on in the last decade. We have weird howling sounds all over the world, and a lot of these have been cracked as conspiracies attached to science sci-fi films trying to create publicity. Right before their movie of Science Invasion, they actually created a weird sound in a movie, and then that's been moved into still photographs or still, you know, just cameras out windows in Russia and forests and major cities, and it's all the same soundtrack. Yeah, that's the funny thing. So someone's stitching the same soundtrack over a bunch of footage, so it's all been debunked out of existence in terms of being legit. Okay. We've also had, and it stopped right now, but we had a lot of meteorite action about 5 years ago. And if for those of you remember, a few years ago, there was the gigantic one over Russia. It was a big ass something or other coming into Earth's orbit, super duper fast. And then there's this massive explosion as it, you know, most of us think, you know, scientifically speaking, if it was real, it was just hitting atmospheric densities to the point where it's getting crushed by the atmosphere and it's also heating up and boiling its interior. So pop, you get this normal pop. And then someone did some analysis on the footage, and it's either been set up from the very beginning to have this anomaly I'm about to talk about in the master footage, or it's real. And I don't have either. It's 50-50 for me, man. But you have this rock coming into Earth very, very quickly. It looks like it's going to cause a problem if it hits, at least locally. And there appears to be another entity made of what appears to be light going faster than the meteorite, and it collides with the meteorite and actually coincides with its big explosion. As if something was shot or something was moving very, very quick to splice this thing in half, to cut it down in size so the impact wouldn't be as intense, or so the atmosphere could burn up all the little dust particles at the end. And this thing was massive. It broke the shit out of windows, broke the sound barrier several times. And so we had lots of these, right? And they're all over the planet at the time. For about 2 or 3 years, we just had massive, massive dashboard, you know, cams of these massive meteorites coming in. Now, the Russians came out and said, oh, this is a weapon from the CIA. They're messing with Russia because we're not willing to play their little monetary game with the World Bank. Yeah, that sort of makes sense with what's going on everywhere else. You know, you have what looks like harp signatures kind of drying out the air and causing famine and fires in Russia. It was a couple of years ago. It's like the Russians had a bunch of physical anomalies, a bunch of atmospheric anomalies that were causing major headaches for them. And we're having cows freezing standing up, too, in the Midwest here. We had the polar vortex, which just happened to be the plot of a movie that was made about 5 years before it actually occurred, right? But let's just say Von Braun was onto something, but it takes 30, 40 years to pull this thing off. And there can't be any anomalies like 9/11 where physics doesn't allow it to happen, right? Okay. Think about the anatomy that would convince mankind that the invaders are here. I don't think it would take much. I don't think it would take everyone sitting down and meeting with them. And because this story, this backstory has been built, supposedly the United States government has the drop on all alien interaction, right? Yes, every country has a dossier of sightings in their areas. They've supposedly talked to aliens in many countries in Europe, especially England. Russia has its own piece. In fact, the Russian Air Force guys have come out and said, most definitely, we've definitely seen and chased things. And there's videos all online, but you can't, with special effects today, you can't discern what's real and what's fake. You know, you just can't. Mexico has shots too. But there's a lot of fake stuff comes out of Mexico as well. People, maybe from here, the United States goes down there, they get some sort of District 9 looking neighborhoods that nobody recognizes, and so they try to splice in, you know, vehicles flying behind buildings and stuff, and it's all rotoscope special effects, and some of them are really good, some are really horrible. But if you look at the old movie, The Day the Earth Stood Still, you had a spacecraft lands, and the alien, this humanoid, Homo sapien looking alien, walks out, but he's got a mask over his face, right? Like, he didn't do the math on how terrifying that would be for a a society that's never seen aliens before. He comes out looking formidable as possible, and then he offers this wand to the lead general who's sitting there looking at him. And of course, one of the soldiers shoots it with the pistol and destroys it. And of course, the guy doesn't have two; he only has one of those things. But inside that was all of the zero-point energy solutions, cures to cancer, everything in the world, and it's over. And they try to incarcerate him, and he escapes. All right. That was just a science fiction thing from, I think, 51 about what an alien would have to do to come and freak us out. It depends on what the arc of the story would be visiting as to how man would react, right? Now, you could they could just orchestrate something where a bunch of crazy vehicles fly around, they get them on camera, they get them at a big event, and everyone's shitting pineapples, right? And immediately, all the governments start working together, right? All the wars are over. Hey, Russia, we're not going to bomb you. China, we love you. And we're all starting to pass policies of unifying the world. It could be just that simple. We don't need grays walking around on the football field for us to freak out. But maybe they could bring a few of those out, film them. Again, what people see on television tends to be what they believe actually really occurred. So keep that one in the back of your brain as you think about aliens. But I think that And I think that I'm preaching to the choir if you're a ufologist to say that we need to calm down the rhetoric about how a super mega intelligent life force would come here and mess with us, right? And be, you know, slave race to get gold out of the ground or slave race to do anything, right? A race that can travel across the universe has plenty of machine power to do anything at all, right? The only thing that might be still coveted would be the consciousness of life. That perhaps thinking, you know, being a real intelligence without the A on the front, maybe that is what would be the most coveted. But then again, if we aren't able to get off this planet, what intellectual capacity could we have that an alien would want to take advantage of, right? I think most people in the world that are, you know, completely asleep, they're just like a factory machine. You know, they could just be replaced the robot putting a top on the top of a tube of toothpaste, you know? So the other last thing, which dovetails within the testimony on the internet, which is very fascinating, and it appears to be, again, a great liar or a great truth teller, is the prominent theory of reptilians from another dimension. Why not go out with a bang, right? That are, this is what David Icke puts forth. And again, I think David has a value that is isolated at a minimum to waking people up. He tends to wake them up and then he puts this other stuff in their brain, which I think is a little suspect because he's never claimed to ever have seen reptilian aliens, but he just talks about them like he knows they exist. I think it's weird because he says he talked to someone who said they saw them. And he says that there's, you know, serpent worship all throughout the history of mankind. Okay. You know, who knows if that just caught on? You know, you get the first, you know, the first cell of man, you know, the first, I mean, body cell, but the first collection of men that manifest the serpent worship, and then they split off and inhabit the world over time. And yeah, they carry that worship with them, you know. So it doesn't mean that they're really, you know, something we have to worry about. But there was a testimony of a guy. I think he's just sitting at a picnic table. I think it's part of Disclosure as well. But they had talked to this guy that worked for, I think it was like Los Alamos Labs or something like that, where he said he walked out into a hallway and he was there as a consultant. I swore he had a British accent to him, which I think, you know, fortunately for Americans, we think anything with a British accent is immediately true. But he kept his story very calm and very interesting. And he said, I walked out of a hallway, is what he said. And he goes, I bumped into this gigantic reptilian humanoid with two black suit, you know, men in black kind of guys to his side. And all he did was he almost bumped into this thing and he looked up at it and he said, it didn't look at me. It's like it was looking straight ahead. And these guys were escorting him to another room. And he said, they never came and talked to him about it. See, hey, you saw that, but you weren't supposed to see that. But they were transferring from one room to another with people walking in the hallway. It's probably a low volume hallway because it's, you know, Q clearance kind of people. The nice thing about this testimony is he goes, I didn't get a single sense that this was an alien. He goes, I got a very distinct sense that someone had messed with humans when he saw it. That's just his impression. I have no opinion because I wasn't there. But very, very interesting that they were able to create a gigantic dude. And I don't remember, I believe it was a 1990 story that he was talking about in the present. But the interesting thing about this worship of interstellar or interdimensional, excuse me, reptilian people is that it goes back into the fabled envelope of total faith-based hysteria. And I think that that provides a cushion for anyone who wants to make a buck off of it. Because you don't need to prove that they exist. You say they exist. And you say, look, they're reptilian minds. It's the old Carl Sagan R-factor brain where they have no empathy, no sympathy. They're just a functioning robot. They do what they're told. They just want to procreate and maybe eat and sleep. And so you have a subject you can write about constantly, and you can liken them to all the darkness in the world. So every politician, every royal monarch that acts, you know, in ways that humanity doesn't act because we're not raised in those horrible bubbles, you know, of, you know, our children go off to get raised by strangers and they send them to boarding schools. They never see their parents and they're beat over the head with all the priorities of the elite families, which is essentially money, 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 control, control, control. That we're blaming that on, and it does have a correlation with the definition of the R-factor mind, but they're correlating this with just essentially being, you know, incubated humans that are then immediately taken over by reptilians, you know. Again, if you look at V, the old series from the 70s, and most of you probably haven't seen it, I think they just rekindled it recently, and I didn't see it. I think they made a movie back in the day, but the idea that these humans were running the world, and that they would go in the back room together and they take their masks off or rip their flesh off and they had like this total reptilian face underneath, this kind of thing. It's just, for me, it's all romanticized stuff, and it propagates the fear that anything from the outside means harm to us. And supposedly, okay, they take the longest, slowest path to destroying mankind. There's no reason if you're a superior alien being that's got ill will towards man that you would wait to give first contact, that you would hide in the fibers of those who run the world. It doesn't make any sense. You just come down and take over this planet if that's what you want. It's not like we could fight back, you know? They said that aliens have stopped wars, right? They say that aliens flew over, a ship would come down and fly over a fully activated nuclear warhead, and supposedly it all deactivated, and they flew off. And there's guys that recently just said it again, you know? They've definitely stopped us from nuclear wars. Those are the cool aliens, I think, are kind of cool. So, if you can travel through the stars, if you can penetrate reality in an interdimensional way, then you got the goods on us, man. You can do whatever the hell you want. You don't have to work slowly making everyone suffer the whole time. You can just show up and make us all suffer. Because a lot of these theories are that these interdimensional beings feed off of our pain. And so they want to create a world that's just in total pain. Well, I don't know. Maybe there's some math to it I don't understand. But I just think that that'd be pretty damn easy to do. Just show up and do it. And maybe their theory is that if you do it real quick, then people won't procreate because they won't want to, and then they lose the whole gamut of suffering. So they go in slowly to make us all suffer. It's weird. But those are one of the fringy stories that you'll find all over the net. You know, there's this anomaly. I want to explain this. This will be where I shut up. Make this a nice, really long episode here. That they'll show you videos on the internet of people that supposedly transformed during interviews. And it just so happens that I was the first outside third-party developer of QuickTime from Apple, which is where you get all the video you're seeing right now. It comes from a genius in Apple who figured out how to do pixel compression. The way this works, just so you know, is that as you're watching this video right now, the only thing being transmitted to your computer are the pixels that actually have moved on camera. So some of these leaves back here that move, my hair is going crazy, I'm moving my hands. If I start doing this, you're getting more data. If I do this, you're just getting a little bit of movement data, right? So those little pixels catch up sometimes because the bandwidth goes down. So these video codecs are absolutely amazing in that they'll measure your average bandwidth and they'll try to give you the quality of photograph that you have in order to render it on your screen. Well, the very first versions were pixel for pixel, 100% accurate pixel. If this moved, you got this frame. And if it got slow, you merely saw a fast-forward blurb of the video as it moves forward. Now they don't do that anymore. One, they vary the quality so that this video is encoded at probably four different qualities at YouTube. And so they give you the lower version of the video. But at the same time, they do something that's in JPEG compression, which is that they'll give, if you have 3 pixels in a row, okay, do like this. They're going to send this first pixel and the last pixel, but they won't send the one in the middle. And what they do is they actually calculate the CMYK light frequency between the two. And so it's generally correct. They generally know that if one pixel is this color and the next pixel is the next color, they can jump over that pixel and calculate it. And that reduces the amount of data transmission. And as long as the codec can run real time, being calculated on your computer, they can just send half the bits. So what ends up happening with a lot of these reptilian, you know, every celebrity's one of them, every politician's one of them. Yeah, some of these guys are total assholes. But when their eyes slit, it's because their eyes are moving. And that's the pixel that has to catch up, right? And so what ends up happening is the artifacting starts getting bad. A circle is a real pain in the ass for these compression algorithms because it's trying to jump over pixels and calculate them on the fly at your computer, right? So what ends up happening is it calculates a circle that's perfectly round. And when you start jumping pixels because bandwidth goes down, it'll actually compress into a more reptilian eye looking shape. And so you get these anomalies, and you also get a lot of flesh anomalies, right? These people that put this forward, and you're probably not one of the people that fall for this kind of stuff, but just so you can explain it to your friends, it's essentially the differential pixels that only get transmitted, and when bandwidth goes bad, it's bad. And what someone will do is that they will scrape the video with a shitty bandwidth at their house, right? So they have a really bad bandwidth at their house. All this video is coming in crappy, and they'll start screen capturing it at their house. And then they republish the screen captured version. So that even if you have amazing bandwidth, you're seeing the screwed up version that they captured online, creating this belief that there's reptilians among us, right? Now, I definitely hope they're not among us because I just told you that they weren't and told you how that is fake. But I guarantee you, when I see it, this was the stuff I was seeing in 1991. I used to drive to Apple headquarters when it was nothing, right? And pick up the discs, the 3.5-inch floppies. And I had to wait in the lobby while the guy's literally building it on the third floor or wherever the hell he was. He'd bring it down and give it to me. I never met the guy. It was really funny. But I'd go down and get it. And we were one of the first companies to ever encode video and use it in our database product. So that's just a little bit of muscle to kind of fight that particular theory. But I hope, if nothing else, this video has given you some thought process to detoxify the UFO projects that are out there, to detoxify the fear of aliens out there. I'm sure most of you have already thought of this stuff, but I think it's not a huge agenda for anything. But I would just say that keep your eyes peeled for some of this knowledge. If we were ever told that they're here, it's probably good that we kind of go, maybe not. It's not that we're going to be able to convince everybody in the Super Bowl that something amazing is not happening, because technically something amazing would be happening. We'd be seeing some covert technology fly around. But I just want you to know those basic theories. I might come back and swing by again, but those are the things I think about constantly. Again, if you haven't been, go to mkultraradio.com. If you haven't subscribe. If you haven't liked it, like it. From our website, you can get to all these deep thoughts in its own tab, but you can also go to our normal show. Normal show is very nebulous and different. We'll try to pick a subject and go for it, but it's typically, you know, way more intense. Deep thoughts are all about the stuff that we think about that we don't really talk about. So I try to bring out all this stuff and put it in one big container so we can kind of correlate things together. And again, I probably have a bunch of stuff wrong in this, but, you know, just comment below and let us know where it is. Link videos, it's cool. But again, if you made it this far, this is the first two-hour episode I've ever done. Thanks for watching, and we'll see you in the next episode. Over and out.